Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I am Paul David, founder and CEO of Literal Humans and your host. And I'm joined today by Arnon Shimoni, the VP of Growth at Solvimon. Welcome, Arnon.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
We met in Amsterdam a couple weeks ago, had a nice coffee at Soho House and recruited you as a podcast guest because you had some good stuff to say. And I was like, we need to get a camera on this guy. So welcome.
Happy to be on camera.
So we're going to be talking about revolutionizing AI monetization and usage-based billing with Arnon today. By way of introduction, Arnon is working at Solvimon, and they are a next-generation billing and monetization platform designed to help modern SaaS companies navigate the complexities of usage-based pricing and hybrid business models.
Among others.
It's
a big business.
And we've not talked a lot about usage-based pricing, so we can dig into that. Arnon is a seasoned marketing and go-to-market leader, and just mentioned Arnon how excited I am to have someone who's another seasoned GTM leader. Arnon literally helped build the AI agent monetization category from the ground up. Talk about that. With over a dozen years of experience across product management, B2B marketing, he's been the driving force behind revenue and payment strategies for some small companies you might have heard of, like Paid, Storytel, and Plio. One of my favorite Plio memories was at Magazine, where you were just at a conference. Y'all had this like stand with whirling cash or whatever.
Yeah, that was so good.
And that was amazing. And I was like, these guys are geniuses. And there were so many people going in that stand and catching cash and then sending the video to everyone they knew. And I think I posted on LinkedIn. So well done.
Such a good strategy there. Well, that wasn't me though.
I mean, that's your team. So let's jump in. First question, we like to kind of ask our guests to paint a picture of the landscape that they're working in for our audience. Talk to us about this shift towards usage-based billing. Why has it been so disruptive to traditional SaaS specifically?
Yeah. So I think in the past, we were used to buying software, right? You get Microsoft Word and you get it on your computer and you run it and that's fine. When things started getting delivered through the internet, then it doesn't make sense to buy a perpetual license, right? So you buy a seat. And that's the normal SaaS thing. And that's created excellent margins for so many companies because the software is kind of hard to build, right? So you would spend a lot of time building the software. And yes, a lot of people say today, oh, it's just a layer on top of a database. Fine. Yeah. But it was still really hard to build back then. So seat-based became the thing. You buy a seat at the table, you buy a seat at the product. And most products still work that way for the vast majority of things. And I think for a lot of people, it felt like a waste. Like, why am I spending a seat if I'm not using it? So in order to try to get a little bit more money out of that, a lot of companies went with usage-based. You only pay for what you use. And it sounds fair, at least in theory. I think there's a lot of limitations to that. And I think there's a lot of companies who have done it very wrong.
Yeah.
And we can talk about that. But this shift is just, it's basically trying to get more money, right? It's a basic growth strategy. Sure. How do we keep growing the revenue when there aren't, you know, there's not that many more people hired at this company? I don't want to buy a seat for them. So I want to get money out of them in another way. So let's charge for usage.
So you're saying that the shift towards usage base is potentially a growth strategy, or it is a growth strategy.
Yes.
So they've looked and they've seen, okay, people are actually using more than maybe the seats are sort of like, help me understand that. Cause I feel like as a business, like who uses, you know, platforms like these, like it's like, oh, we've got the seat and we're not really using it. So it feels like we're using less, but yeah, help me understand that piece.
So think about, let's say Figma, right? Yeah. So it's a tool that you use, right? Yeah. To design stuff, and you can give people a seat. Yeah. You hire someone, just give them a seat and let them use it. But for a lot of people, they don't really need it. They're just viewing, or they might want to add a comment.
Yeah.
And then you have to start distinguishing between types of seats, and that gets complicated. And then you have to upgrade, downgrade seats. So why not just bill for what you use? So if you create a new, like a new artboard, or you know, we can limit you to the number of frames or the number of like groupings or whatever that you do. So that's where usage-based would come in. Mm-hmm. And like the more, you know, the more serious users, they would pay more. And the ones who are just dabbling, you don't have to pay a lot for that. So that sounds reasonable. I think there's a trap in that, which is very dangerous, which is it tends to create like a disincentive for you to use it.
Interesting.
Because if you think, I have to pay for every time I create a new frame, then I'm just going to hack stuff in like and use the product incorrectly. I'm just going to stuff everything in one frame, or I'm going to have everything in one file instead of splitting it up.
Do you see that limiting people though, or changing how people use the products then? Because they know they're being like, are you seeing that in the space? Like people,
it's a little bit of both. I think you have to be really clever in how you design the upgrades from there. So yeah, I think if I'm just an occasional user, yes, I might hack the product and use it in a way that it wasn't necessarily intended to get around these growth and monetization strategies. But if you're if I'm in a big company and I don't really care, then I'll just use. And I think that's what a lot of these companies like Figma, like so many others in HubSpot, everyone's doing it. That's what they're banking on, that you're not going to bother with thinking, oh, am I using, am I not?
It's interesting you mentioned Figma, because Figma is literally the tool. I mean, we use it for design and we've got probably more seats than we need, but like every month I get that Figma bill and I literally look at the number of seats and I send it to our chief of staff and our senior designer. And I'm like, guys, like, what's happening here? Yeah. Do we need to be paying this much for my seat to occasionally view work that's being done and like so on and so forth? So I love that example you brought.
And that's the thing, right? You kind of, this usage-based thing, it has to be designed correctly. Right. And not just the usage, the seat-based has to be designed correctly.
Yeah.
And I've seen personally what happens when you design it incorrectly.
Yeah.
So I'll give you an example from Plio, where you said, we launched a free plan, which was limited to up to 5 users. So if you were up to 5 users, you could use our free plan. You don't pay for it.
Right.
It's a pretty good value.
Right.
But then when you want to jump to a 6th user, there was no upgrade path other than you need to now move to the pro plan.
Right.
And the pro plan was 10 euros or 10 pounds per user.
Yep.
And then suddenly you're going from 0 to paying 60 just because you added 1 user.
Yep.
So in people's minds, it's not, oh, a user is 10 euros. Yep. Adding 1 user is now 60 euros.
Yep.
So the value isn't there. Like the value wasn't aligned really well.
Yep.
So that's like an example of maybe a design that was not great. And I fought a lot to change that.
Interesting. We're going to sort of bridge into the work that's going on at Solvimon, but I also want to stay in this space of kind of painting the landscape.
Yep.
So, you know, two sort of landscape questions. One, understand how the work that you're doing at Solvimon, your architecture, kind of reflects the increasingly complex revenue stack needs that a lot of companies have, you know, kind of operating at the intersection of banking level precision and kind of this B2B SaaS flexibility. And then also this piece around like helping companies bridge that gap between sort of complex usage data and kind of that simple and what they hope to be a transparent invoice for the end customer.
Yeah. Well, that's a really big question.
Yeah.
You have so many bits to that.
Yes.
I'm actually going to start from the end because
you said
it should be a simple and transparent invoice. Mm-hmm. There's a word that's coming up a lot now because of ChatGPT and Claude, and it's clarity.
Sure.
I really hate that word right now because I keep seeing it. But the pricing does not need to be simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to have complex pricing, multiple layers, multiple aspects to it. I think that's what makes it good,
sure,
because that's how you get growth. Again, I'm thinking from the business perspective.
Yeah.
But the user, the person who's buying that from you, they need to understand how it works. You have to be transparent about how you're doing things,
right,
and you have to reflect that in the what you hand out to them at the end of every month, which is the invoice, right? But it doesn't have to be simple,
right?
Because simple usually implies, oh, I'll just go for a good, better, best. And everyone does that.
Yep.
And it's fine for a while. It gets you to a certain point. But most companies realize that they have to graduate from that.
Of course. Yeah.
And by the way, that's where we operate. So Solvimon was originally created by 2 people who came out of Etienne. So Kim and Etienne, the co-founders.
Yep.
And they had built a financial billing system for Etienne inside Etienne.
Okay.
So it's like a spin-off, really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's always the piece within the piece that becomes the...
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you can think of it almost like the way that banks and fintechs work internally is so much more complicated than Figma or Miro or HubSpot, because there's so many, like, you pay this much percentage here and this one, and then there's caps and graduated levels and stair step and sticky stair step.
Yeah.
There's all these like really weird pricing things that most people have never heard of.
Of course,
But that's how a lot of fintechs work, and that's how they make their money.
Yeah.
So that was basically a spinoff to handle that complexity, because a lot of companies need that complexity,
mm-hmm,
or let's call it flexibility, not complexity. They want the flexibility to play around with a lot of different levers and factors. And that's really hard to do with Stripe
or
one of those more off-the-shelf components.
Sure. Moving into products, you know, talking about how AI native companies design monetization that doesn't stifle growth. Like, so obviously that's kind of the goal there. So y'all are specializing in designing personalized monetization strategies for AI companies. I would love to understand, like, what are some of the biggest mistakes that you see out there when they're, you know, when startups are first kind of moving away from that flat fee or sort of seat-based subscription? Like, what are the stumbles that you see them making?
The first one is just leaning very direct, very heavily into the usage-based, by the way.
Yeah. What does that look like? Like, what does it mean to lean too heavily in usage-based? Like,
a lot of companies start creating these kind of proxies for inputs. Credits and tokens, which everyone
loves a token.
Yeah, you know, gets familiar
what
with.
What is a token?
Exactly. That's the thing. So it's a lot of layers of obfuscation.
Yeah,
so you're paying, you know, 10 cents for every million input tokens and maybe 8 cents for every million output tokens. I don't have a mapping for that in my head.
Yeah.
And then Those are paid through credits. So you pre-buy credits so that you can burn down the tokens as time progresses. And then, so it's good for the company who's selling that they've detached the value of what you're buying from the cost, but it gets so complicated to understand. And then there isn't that called clarity or transparency in what you're buying.
Right.
So that is heavily usage-based, but it's usage on input and on what is effectively a proxy for compute. So you're paying their cost. You're not paying for what you're getting out of it. You're not paying for value.
Yeah.
You're paying for their OpenAI bill or their GPU inference if they're doing it directly.
Yeah.
And I think that's like a very incorrect approach. It's like going to a restaurant and you're paying for each individual spice that goes into your meal.
Gosh,
I don't want to do that. Hide that away from me.
Yeah.
I'm buying a dish. I'm buying it because I want to feel something. I want it to be special. I don't care how much the individual rice kernel that went into the dish cost.
Yeah. There's tension there though too, right? Obviously, because like companies are always looking for ways to kind of optimize and, you know, like squeeze more out of the way that they price and you know, value-based pricing and things like that.
Big believer in value-based pricing.
Definitely. Like we're doing some fascinating stuff with the health tech company now that's, you know, working on, you know, we've got, we get $27 reimbursed for Medicaid and we can, you know, and it's like really fascinating to dig into that and say, okay, you know, what are you delivering? And if we bring you more, you know, Medicaid eligible folks, so on and so forth. And
that's the holy grail.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It's really, and like to help founders think more in that way is like one of my favorite parts of the job. It's just like, and then they start to like think about their entire revenue model. And then if you can unlock that, then that just helps them scale. And that's beyond even what we're delivering as GTM strategists and marketers. I think that's interesting. Would love to dig into, like you mentioned the end user and like the value they're getting out of it. So this question of like how Solvimon, how you all help companies change their pricing or kind of launch new features for some customers without accidentally breaking things for everyone else. That seems like a really tight road.
Ooh, that's a hard one. What a lot of companies do is they launch new pricing and they just move everyone in one go.
Also, if you have horror stories, we'd love to hear that.
I don't want to go into specific horror stories because it's just so technical and I actually don't think it's that interesting. A blog post about this, there's this concept of grandfathering where you get grandfathered onto a plan. Right? Phone companies do it all the time. And that creates so much complexity because then if you want to move to the next plan, sometimes there's no, they don't know. You have to create in the system that you're running this billing and everything. You have to create a process for what does it mean to move from this plan to that plan? And the reason you have to do it is because it's not just, oh, I'm moving from good to better. You're moving from, I get this many minutes to that many minutes. Now I was on 4G, now I get 5G.
Yeah.
That's the concept of what I would call an entitlement. Mm-hmm. You're suddenly entitled to new stuff. So that upgrade path has to be defined somehow. Now, a lot of companies do that manually. So they put that in the code. If you're upgrading from this to this, here's what happens. And they code it in the pricing pages, which is one aspect. That's the front of house. And then there's the back of house, like what's happening in the billing system. Sometimes you have to update it in your CRM so that you know that the customer is upgrading and you know what they're getting. Sometimes you actually have to generate a quote for them to sign because it's special pricing that a salesperson agreed with.
Right.
Sometimes it's product led where you just go and you do it yourself. Yeah. Then you actually have to document all of that in an ERP because you're creating different liabilities with the revenue, which is crazy and something that most people don't think about. And I don't want to think about it. I really hate it. So 6, I 15, the really down to the nitty gritty like bookkeeping details.
Right.
Really boring, by the way, my least favorite stuff to deal with. But you have to think about that whole stack, that whole, like every step of that puzzle. And most companies will handle one or two of those and forget about the rest.
Right.
And that's okay when you're a small company and you're just growing because you don't really need to be compliant with anything.
Yeah.
For a big company, they don't have that luxury. They get audited regularly and they have to be compliant. So dealing with that entire stack is what Solvimon does. And that's the plan from day one.
Yeah.
And we can talk about whether that was the right approach in building a company, by the way, because I think we spoke about when we met in Amsterdam, there's an American way of doing things where you just build stuff and it doesn't have to be compliant.
Blow through.
And you'll deal with it when you have to. Right?
Yeah.
And the European approach is more like, let's build something that's 100% compliant and then we'll go to market with it, which I think is potentially an issue. We can talk about that in the subsequent question. But to answer that question, that whole flow of from the point where someone thinks, oh, maybe I want to upgrade. I want to see what the next thing is.
Yeah.
What does it actually cost me to move up? Not just cost, but like, can I do it? I think a lot of companies don't have that worked out really well.
Yeah,
so, so Solvimon handles that end to end in just one platform.
Right.
We're not the only ones who do it, but we're definitely one of the only ones.
Super interesting. You mentioned the cultural differences too. I've been seeing that. We met with some other companies in Amsterdam who are working in climate tech, for example, and they're being very cautious and careful, but also planful about, intentional about, you know, building around and building for these like regulatory moats that are coming up, particularly in spaces like sustainable textiles and building optimization, things like that, and kind of building it into their business model and saying, hey, you know, we can now help all these companies, all these businesses essentially do compliance and get paid for it by delivering our product to them in a way that de-risks their doing business, because we then become the least risky option for them to stay compliant or to be compliant, which has been really fascinating. And it's such a different way, I think, of thinking than what we see in the States largely. So it's a really, really good point you mentioned there. You mentioned how Solvimon's positioning itself. I want to dig into that. How are y'all working to kind of handle those unique billing requirements, you know, of autonomous agents? Like, how does that make sense? Like, how, because I think our audience would love to understand, like, how do you arrange all those pieces together in a way that works?
So I'll start with the holy grail, which is you price per outcome. Well, I talked a lot about this last year, if anyone's been following me. I only want to pay for the stuff that the agent did for me that ended up being valuable.
Give us an example.
So if you're talking about like a sales agent, like an AI SDR, which there are probably 60 of at this point, it can say, oh, well, you know, I scoured the internet. I found 70 leads for you.
Yep.
I don't want to pay for 70 leads. Yeah. I don't know what that means. I don't know if they're good or not. So the next step is like, oh, I'll score them for you. Okay. That's still kind of an input.
Yeah.
But if it could book a meeting for me, a meeting has a lot more value than here's a list of 70 leads. And if the meeting was a good meeting, then I can tell the agent, hey, this was actually a good meeting. Learn from that. I'm willing to pay you more for this kind of meeting as opposed to that other kind of meeting. Okay. So that's like one example. Another example is a company that I worked with back at Paid last year, a company called Alpha 7X. This guy in Florida, he has completely changed how banks deal with mortgages. So he built this agent that handles the mortgage application. And he's effectively, unfortunately, displaced people in the bank. These people, like, they're not fired. They're doing other things.
Yeah.
But instead of spending many, many hours and sometimes days processing an application, he can get it done in minutes with his agent.
And these are bank officials who, like...
It's working for the bank.
Yeah, interesting.
So now instead of, I don't know, 17 people, there's two people working on the mortgages and everyone else can go do other stuff. And the value there is... The agent gets paid for every successful mortgage application.
Exactly,
the bank makes money off the mortgage. He just takes a cut out of that.
Instead of just getting paid for like sort of shuffling papers and processing for an application that maybe won't go through.
Exactly.
You spend all that time looking at, okay, that's really interesting.
So he only gets paid for successful mortgage applications.
So incentivized to do more, to do it very correctly.
Exactly.
Yeah, interesting.
And when you think about that, that creates a shared incentive, both for the vendor of the software to make sure that the software gets better, the agent gets better and improves over time.
Yeah.
And for the bank or the person buying it, it creates like this shared motivation to be better. Whereas with the classic SaaS software, you were buying software that didn't necessarily change a whole lot over time.
Is there any kind of moral hazard there to the kind of like fudge the numbers and help the application go through?
Ooh, yes, there is. Of course. But that's always been there. And that's always that's the case when you you pay sales compensation.
Sure.
I should do a salesperson, right? And I've seen that happen too.
Yeah. It might not be the best sale, probably shouldn't have gone through, but it did. And the salesperson gets a cut, and it doesn't mean it was the right sale at the right time. But
And what I'm seeing now, by the way, and this is a slight segue or maybe a slight detour, but deal desks are having a really hard time now with all these salespeople who are given free range to close whatever deal for whatever conditions. And that's another thing that we are starting to handle at Solvimon is giving the flexibility to close those deals that went out of the normal scope of what the company was originally intending. Creating that flexibility, like, because, you know, these are valuable deals in the end.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't think about how this deal would be structured when we designed the pricing, but this sales executive or salesperson was creative.
Yeah.
He closed a really good deal, profitable. Yeah. Let's make it work. Right? Let's make sure that the system supports that and we're not hacking it in.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I'm thinking. That's the way that we're building things now. But this whole concept of agents, if you think about them as an autonomous thing that can do things for you, then I want to pay for the result. I don't want to pay for, I burned 70,000 tokens, you know, searching the internet for something. That's not valuable to me. And going back to a question from earlier, that's the risk with usage-based pricing, where the usage is a proxy for the input and not what you're getting out of it. And I think that's a mistake that a lot of companies are going into.
Are you seeing that like shift towards like pay for outcomes? Do you feel like that's catching on as kind of like a cultural?
It's a hard one.
Yeah. Why is it so hard?
It's really hard to attribute in a lot of cases. So if you think about this sales agent that we talked about, the sales agent might say, hey, I booked this meeting. But then another person said, well, no, I fed the agent all the data. I selected it. I should get the attribution. Why are we paying that? I could have done that myself.
Yeah.
So then the attribution becomes a little bit murky.
Have a share,
you could,
maybe.
But then every customer has a different feeling about what is this worth for me.
But if you quantify it, should it not matter?
Like it's still extremely individual.
Okay.
Think about if I'm in a very low margin industry and you book a meeting for me and it's the agent books a meeting for me and I get a $30 deal out of it, I don't want to pay the same for a meeting that resulted in a $70,000 deal.
Yep.
So that you have to kind of agree about what that outcome is worth.
Sure.
And that's really hard because it changes over time. It changes based on the outcome that's actually delivered. And it has to be in an agreement. And writing that agreement and making sure that it sits in the system that handles that it's not trivial at all.
It's a lot.
So that's a risk. But I mean, there's also that momentum of like, I as a CFO potentially want to pay a fixed amount. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have this flexibility where I don't know how much I'm going to pay.
Variable costs are kind of there.
And I think CFOs who think that way it's starting to go away because usage-based is a thing and you don't always know what you're going to pay. But I would say a CFO who's willing to, who's willing to say, I don't want to pay for successful outcomes that improve my business and give me more revenue.
Yeah.
That's a very short-sighted look.
Yeah, totally. Like you want to take a little bit on the chin in terms of like initial, maybe somewhat variable costs, control them within reason, but you see the long-term gain in that though.
But hopefully. Exactly. Yeah. But at the same time, it makes their life so much more difficult because the forecasting isn't there. So that's what I mean by this whole revenue stack kind of has to be built with that in mind.
Because then it's like almost like a technical solve to help that CFO understand and like feel in control of like those near term sort of variable costs maybe.
Yes.
And then
because you know what happens at the end of the month, they get called up to the board and like, why are the numbers so wildly different? Like, do you not know how to close the books? Do you not know how to do this? Why, like you expected this much, we only got this much, or we paid this much more. What are you doing? And the CFO has to answer for that, which is a really tough position to be in.
Yep.
So I don't blame them. We need to get better with the tools. We need to be able to improve their workflow too. And that's, again, that's part of this short-sightedness of a lot of the tools that you buy for billing, for revenue, for entitlement management, for growth on the website, like pricing pages. They don't consider that whole flow.
Yeah.
So they're only addressing a small part of it. You get a growth person, a product person, or CTO, someone buying that, and then they're not thinking about the downstream effects.
Yeah, yeah.
By the way, that was one of the hardest things I learned when I started building these systems at Plio is there are so many downstream effects that you just can't predict.
You can't predict them, yeah, okay. So how could people think about them if they can't
predict them? And you can talk about them.
Sure.
But it goes in from one year next to the
other. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
People forget.
People are very short-sighted and short memories and not much foresight. Let's talk about growth strategy. I know it's something we both want to get to and kind of thinking about the roadblocks and opportunities that are ahead for Solvimon and your team in 2026. You all positioned yourselves as a platform for companies that have outgrown simple billing. Tell us, is one of the biggest roadblocks just getting companies to realize that they've outgrown their current setup? Or is it the technical hurdle of kind of migrating them away from legacy systems, maybe like Stripe or something?
Look, the migration is always a pain, but it's
not the biggest.
It's a pain for everything. Like if you're on Notion and you're like, oh, I don't want to use Notion. I want to use Obsidian now. That's still a migration, right? So,
do you recommend Obsidian, by the way?
I tried it. It's fine. Okay. My partner loves it. I'm still on Notion.
Okay.
I'm still on Notion.
Because we're thinking about the same. Yeah. Okay.
I'm still Team Notion. Yeah. We can talk about my entire technology stack,
let's
by the way.
Let's do that. Yeah.
That'd
be a cool add-on to send a list to share.
Yeah, absolutely. The hard part is that understanding, because if you are building a new company today, I don't blame you for going with Stripe. It's the easiest. It's very much in the zeitgeist, right? Yeah. If I go on Cursor and I'm just like, right, hey, add a billing page or I want to take a credit card, which
Stripe's
is what,
right there.
Yeah, okay. It will default to Stripe.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And that's fine. I don't blame them. Our product has more hurdles. It's not designed to be used by a person who just wants to take a credit card and, you know, deal with 30 subscriptions a month. It's not for
again, it's that upfront work to like, okay, you're going to spend a little bit more time and energy now, but the benefits in the back end, similar to what you're saying about like the CFO and the variable costs.
But it's like you don't build for scale before you've even seen your initial traction, right? It would be silly. It would be silly for me to go and implement Salesforce if I haven't even proven my business yet.
Exactly,
so I'm going to go with Pipedrive or Adeo or potentially HubSpot. Even HubSpot's getting a little bit big for what it is, right? And by the way, big HubSpot fan.
But
at the same time, I understand that you might not want to start with it.
Exactly.
And when you get to a certain stage where you need that feature, then you migrate to it. I think with the revenue stack, that question of what do I move to next is not usually top of mind because stuff doesn't hurt. It's treated like an engineering problem.
Right,
you just tell the lead engineer who did that initial integration, hey, I want to add another pricing page or I want to change the pricing. Go out and do it for me.
Yeah.
And they'll either do it in the Stripe dashboard or they'll change some code to make it work.
And you're saying it should be treated as a growth problem? Is that the shift?
So what I think happens is when you get to that point, it already really hurts.
Okay.
And then you're panicking because you get that pressure from above, from the board. We want to see new pricing. Why aren't you differentiating your AI pricing?
Yeah.
AI is an excellent trigger for this.
Right.
Because a lot of AI features should not be bundled in the normal subscription because they cost a lot of money.
Right.
So then the default, by the way, is let's do tokens and credits.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Yeah.
Stripe is not great at tokens and credits. Yeah. They bought Metronome now, which I think is an excellent defensive strategy against OpenAI, by the way.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I think they were afraid OpenAI would end up building their own billing.
Yeah. They're just like, snatch it.
So they snatched it from them. Yeah. But then, it becomes a growth problem. Not growth in the classic marketing sense, but revenue growth. You need to show results, and then that really hurts.
We'd love to talk a bit about Solvimon's intention to scale beyond the EU. You're now moving into kind of automating billing processes, and you got this headquarters in the Netherlands. We'd love to understand the regulatory piece we talked about before, and kind of their sort of regional growth pains that you have as you're scaling into different regions, especially in Europe, as opposed to scaling into UK or the States, and how they're thinking about usage-based billing as kind of a standard. So we'd love to understand like your growth, so your regional growth strategy off the back of that not so recent raise, I guess.
Yeah. It's the EU is really easy to work in.
Yeah.
I think we don't give it enough credit.
Yeah.
There's that one-stop shop.
I don't know.
Well, because the languages are different and the formatting is a little bit different. Yeah. But otherwise, an invoice is an invoice within the EU. It's pretty formalized. There's one-stop shop EU database. You can verify other companies' VAT ID, VAT GST ID. So it actually works really well, and you don't have to do a whole lot to work from one country in the EU to all the others.
In some ways, the regulations like narrow the field of play, kind of in a way.
It's pretty easy actually. Solvimon was built globally to begin with. We have customers in the US. Serving customers in the US is actually a lot more difficult because of the tax situation. Because it depends what you're selling to where you're selling it and where you're based. And if you've reached Nexus, it's actually really, really complicated. So we have partnered with companies like Avalara and Sphere and to deal with that, the VAT tax issues.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is the hardest part of that global situation. Otherwise, we're partnered with Adyen, who is an excellent payment partner, and they sort us out throughout the entire world, so we have no problem. And we work with Stripe too, so wherever Adyen doesn't cover, Stripe covers, we have full coverage for that. So in terms of thinking about where to go next, I'm actually really bullish on the European Union and the Europe in general. There's so many really hot companies in Europe, and I think they're a little bit underserved by American companies like Stripe.
Yeah.
So Stripe's tax has not changed since at least 2022.
Interesting,
And it's not really great for Europe.
Yeah.
So you have to bring in a third-party partner as well, but we cover that from day one and built into the system. So you don't have to buy another system to do that.
Interesting.
So I'm really bullish on operating in Europe. I think we have excellent taste in Europe.
Yeah.
You look at all the interesting design that comes from Europe and like fashion. It's all French, Italian, a little bit UK here, right?
Yeah.
There's a sense of style here and a sense of taste that I think is massively underappreciated.
Yeah.
And I kind of want to lean into that. I'm not sure if it's a good growth strategy, by the way.
Sure.
It's just my current hypothesis. Yeah, I want to see that play.
There's a reason we live over here, and I'm bullish on it too. I mean, I think it gets a lot of discredit, culturally, they don't want it enough. They're not hungry enough and stuff like that. And the round, all the rounds aren't big enough.
But I'm a little bit tired of the dunking on Europe, be honest.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, there's people are always like, why did you move from the States to London and start a business? And I'm like, guys, like, look around. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of latent and real potential here. And I just think, I don't love the dunking on Europe. It seems a bit silly to me. Yeah, most of our clients are in the U.S. and I get it. You know, I can play ball over there.
But that's where the money is.
Totally.
And I get that.
Yeah. But I appreciate what you're saying about like let's not be so quick and so you know facile about just we're just here to dunk on Europe. So
I was at an 11 Labs event yesterday. That's a company out of here.
Yeah. Where are they from? 11 Labs.
I think they're from here. I think they're from
UK. Okay, gotcha.
But there was so much talent there. There were Italians and Greeks and Spaniards. Like, so they hire pretty much from all of Europe. You have Harvey, you have Legora, you have Lovable, you have Strawberry. Mm-hmm. Like, there's so many interesting companies from this region.
Totally.
I would not discount that at all.
I don't think we should. We'll have to more or less cut it there. I want to get in one quick question just about like you've had all these amazing roles, a couple different companies, you've worked globally. If you could share with our audience, you know, a lesson or two about, you know, leadership, about, you know, GTM strategy. What are some of the core lessons that you've learned across the years that you carry with you into this role at Salvimo?
So I think in the recent year or year and a half, it's been a trend to like, oh, let's try to automate everything. Let's make everything with AI.
Let's generate
all the content with AI. Yeah. And I think that misses the point.
Totally.
Because if you can do it, everyone else can do it.
Yeah, exactly.
You see all these, plan to get my plan for how to do everything easily with Claude. And it's interesting as a technology. Like, sure. I'm curious about it and I'll try it too. Yeah. But I think we're losing something very, very fundamental here,
really?
Which is, again, that sense of taste, which humans have. That, and when everyone does the same, then you're doing nothing. If you look at a lot of the brands that are coming out today, a lot of them are designed by the same tools. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, yeah, I'll spend $50 and vibe code a website on, again, Lovable, Replit, exactly. Whatever. And they all kind of look the same.
Yeah,
and when everything looks the same, you've lost. You've already lost. You're fighting from a point of disadvantage.
Something about like zigging when everyone else is zagging, you know, and I was speaking with our senior consultants about this today, like this idea of like invoices. We're actually talking about invoices and it's sort of like, why have we now automated, you know, you have your biggest client and they pay on time and, you know, the day after they, you know, maybe they, whatever, it was on a Sunday or something like that, the day after they maybe haven't paid on time like they normally do, it's the middle of the month, they get an automated invoice and they're just like, come on, man, like, you know that I pay on a regular basis, I'm your biggest client, we've been in business for years, you know, and it's just like, yes, we can automate, but like, should we? And like, what is the human impact of that automation?
Yeah.
You know, because you've now sent a signal to your biggest client, like that you've automated, you're just chasing. And it's like, you got to really think about, you know, what are we automating? What's the impact
going to
be?
So, and when we work in marketing,
everything
that we put out is a contact point with our customers. Yeah. So by the way, the invoice, I think invoices are completely underappreciated as a point of contact with someone.
Totally.
It's a touch point.
Yeah.
You should use that to show a little bit of yourself, a little bit of your culture.
Exactly.
So if you put out an invoice, it just says, you know, just, it doesn't even have your logo, it just has like company name. It's just
put a personal note. Like one thing we're looking at too, like interesting, like a, you know, semi-automating kind of like an impact report. So like when you get an invoice, like why shouldn't you have like three data points of the impact that we've had on your business? You know what I mean? Like,
so I invented like that last year at Pate. We called it a value receipt.
Yeah.
And it's something that comes attached to your invoice.
I love that. We're going to use that.
Where we put in the human value equivalent of what the AI agent did for you.
Right.
So if you're building an agent, you have to report these metrics. That's how we would bill.
Yeah.
And then we also attach that. And you can decide if you want to use it or not. But yeah, you have to show your value.
That's really.
But also, here's a growth hack in your invoice.
Yeah.
Put in something fun, something new, or you know, something to look forward to, so that they open your invoice and not just, oh, I'll look at it later. You can. It can be something as silly as putting in a joke, and you can have automate that. It's not difficult.
You can automate that. Yeah. But I mean, we call it surprise and delight. You know,
exactly.
And like, what are the little things that we're gonna do? I had a client who, you know, she was like, oh, I'm going to this conference in Detroit. I'm anxious. I'm on this panel. I'm not ready. It took me 30 minutes. I, you know, worked with obviously like Gemini and Claude, and I put together like an executive briefing package and then analyzed, you know, who's gonna be on the panel. Here's some questions for them. Here's, you know, something in common between
two.
And she was like, oh my gosh, you know, just like little thing. And I had to do that. I was just like, I really like her. I really like this business. She's one of my clients. Like, why not? I've got the time. And, you know, she loved it. And I'm sure it bought us a lot of capital, you know, social capital. And just, it's a kind, good thing to do. So
100%. And it's so easy. You just have to do 5% more than someone else.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Right?
And not even thinking about the return, like that's just the right thing to do. But like that probably bought us like a couple more months of the engagement, you know, just because she's like, man, like, you know, I really love these guys. Like
you added
little bits. Yeah.
Surprising.
Yeah, it's a great place to cut it. We'll have to cut it there. But one thing, I just love this episode because I'm a big fan of like your, you know, brain in terms of like growth strategy and go-to-market work and also this technical world of billing infrastructure as we just landed on. Like,
so technical.
It can be technical, but it also can be more human as we just kind of landed on. And I think what y'all are doing in terms of like helping people think about, you know, building that revenue stack and you know, diversifying it and making it more complex, but also simpler, I think is really, really fascinating. You know, the monetization piece, it's not just about like the price tag. There's like a core product experience out to that. And I think that's what's interesting about
monetization is so hot right now. Everyone's talking about it.
It is.
So
it is.
It's so weird because, again, I've been doing this for, I guess, since about 2020.
Yeah. It was like, it was cool. Yeah. Well,
so like no one wakes up and says, oh, I want to do billing. Yeah. Let's be honest. But it is beginning to be a lot more attractive. Right. And I'm seeing a lot of people, like people are writing books about it now.
Totally. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's cool. It's pretty good. It's pretty cool.
Well, for folks who are interested in learning more about Sagamon and monetization, let our listeners know where they can find out more about you and the work that you're doing at Sagamon.
Anand Shiboni on LinkedIn, anand.dk, that's my personal blog. I write up there sometimes, and sagamon.com for the company, and I'm putting out content there too.
Nice.
About pretty much once a week, there's a new blog post, new insights, stuff coming out, so very much worth the follow.
We'll put those links in the episode description, and I just want to thank you for your time today.
Absolutely.
I've got a busy couple of days in London, and I appreciate you sharing it with us. And for our listeners, please give us a review, give us a 5-star rating so we can keep bringing great guests like Arnunch at Sagamon onto the pod today. Thanks, y'all. Have a good one. I did it.
Yeah.
30.